The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. This is Bill Buford, and welcome to episode one of War Notes, a conflict podcast. The title of this podcast is War Notes, the Collapse of American Military Power. So, some housekeeping, as it were. Some of you are familiar with the other podcast that I do, which is called Chasing Ghost, an Irregular Warfare Podcast. I've sort of squeezed out of that on occasion with excursions and dispatches that I published on my Substack page that discuss things that are outside of the irregular warfare rubric, that are outside of the milieu of irregular warfare as a subset of all conflict and warfare in Earth's history and contemporaneously. So I want to assure my audience for Chasing Ghost and Irregular Warfare, I will be continuing that fortnightly podcast, but I thought that in these tumultuous and tempestuous times that we have now, that why don't I lend a hand in expanding the understanding and apprehension of the world the way we see it today, because we all know that the world that we see today is one that is floated, animated, and reinforced, fortified, one may say, by everything that has happened before us. As I've said previously, history is delightfully interesting for the intellectually curious, and it isn't simply dates and times, although those are convenient markers and addenda in research to instantiate just what's going on and why did it happen, but it is cause and effect in unintended consequences and chaos avalanches and cascades of calamities and all of those kind of things that make history what it is and leads us to the time that we are today. For instance, one thing in the historiography, the examination of history from an amateur standpoint, after all, I am not credentialed. I am not a member of the American Historical Association or any of the other Marxist confabulations of fantasy history that so dominate the academy and university landscape today. I am one who examines things in a way in which I can read, I can look at the primary source documentation, I can look at the secondary source documentation, I can look at the archives, I can even use Mortimer Adler's adage from his book, Syntopical Reading, which is that when one, not just me, but anybody there in my listening audience, and those of you who read my occasional dispatches at my Substack, you will discover that syntopical reading, thank you, Mortimer Adler, is where one reads a minimum of 3 to 5 books on the same subject, and if you're an active reader and you pay attention and you mark your marginalia on the pages and you examine the footnotes, and maybe you even go so far as to look at those footnotes and look them up and find other books and other compilations and aggregations of knowledge that are an inquiry into that particularly arcane subject you may be examining. And what you'll discover is that you become smarter and smarter as an active reader about what the single most accurate picture is of what happened then, so that we'll know what the single most accurate picture is of what is happening now, so that we can forecast, not predict, forecast, because the evidentiary needs for forecasting are a little less rigorous than prediction. And one can forecast what's going to happen in the future. For instance, what you'll discover is that from 1945, the end of World War II, until this time, for the most part, and I've mentioned this in my other podcast, and I'll mention it now for any new listeners, America has lost every conflict it has fought. Now, some naysayers will say, but Bill, how can that be possible when We defeated the Iraqis in 1991. Well, if that is the case, why did one return in 2003? Now, there are many reasons that that happened, and that's one thing that you'll find manifested here. No one can answer all of these questions and then make the claim, well, I have the answer. I am not making the claim to have all of the answers. I am making the claim that I have done the work and the intellectual heavy lifting to arrive at, once again, what I portray as the single most accurate picture of what is going on now, what has gone on then, and using those two items in combination to do a forecast of what is going to happen in the future. For instance, so we have this almost pristine record of military stalemate and defeat on behalf of the American state, in spite of the fact that America and the West, America in particular, spends an extraordinary amount of money, near $1 trillion a year in the national budget, when one considers that Department of Energy cutouts for nuclear items and research and such, it does approach $1 trillion. And of course, there are all those budget items where one, for instance, with Ukraine, since a special military operation, the billions of dollars that have been sent to the grand stage of the Ukraine so that America and the West can take the very best exquisite platform weapon systems that it has, put it in the first and only near-peer and peer conflict that has occurred in the 21st century, and then have those all on display for Russia and its BRICS allies to observe, take notes, change their tactics, techniques, and procedures, go back to the drawing board on their own exquisite platforms, and also to consider what is going to happen in the future as a result of letting the technological cat out of the bag with all of the weapon systems that have been given, loaned, or in some fashion from the ledger books, landed on Ukrainian soil to be used against Russian forces. This has been an intelligence boon for Russia and the BRICS, BRICS, of course, including China, which means that in the future, with any near-peer or peer conflict adventures that the U.S. and the West engages in, whether that is the Pacific or the European continent, we, in this case, the U.S. government and NATO and other modalities like that, have sort of taken the cat out of the bag and shown the world for all to see just what is there. Now, mind you, I am quite pessimistic, and I have been in the 50-plus episodes of my Chasing Ghosts podcast quite critical of the Western way of war and how it has fared in that particular rubric, how it has fared in counterinsurgency and insurgency, counter-guerrilla, guerrilla, special operations, and all those kind of things. It has fared poorly. It has done not well at all. What you discover is that one can throw all the money that you want at something, but if you throw that money at it, you better make sure that you are aware of all the revolutions in military affairs that are contemporaneous to the conflicts that you are either engaged in or you're going to engage in, and that you have to take into account the fact that the enemy always gets a vote. I am fond of saying that wars are won by the least incompetent forces. One of the reasons I say that, there are several reasons, of course, is because the largest collision and just direct conflict between complex adaptive systems, in this case, armies, navies, all the aggregates above and beyond, and the grand strategic political actors that inform those movements if generals are puppeteered on the ground in what they do to achieve strategic and grand strategic objectives, all of those things inevitably will go awry despite the most concrete plans that are made to make sure that things go in the direction that the antagonists want. Historically, you will rarely find those who start wars in the first place, who say, yeah, we're going to be grinding on this for years, we're going to be draining the treasury, and many bodies will be stacked on both sides. Most of them are confident, especially political actors who are not experienced in warfare, historically literate, nor can extrapolate the unintended consequences and second and third order effects of starting a war, will say this will be done in a week or two. We all know that that's a lie. I want to set up a preamble here, run rules, as it were, on who am I as this uncredentialed amateur historian. And by the way, I prize those descriptors of who I am. I don't work at a university. I do have a graduate degree. I don't have a graduate degree in history. I am not a published historian in any venue whatsoever, except on blog posting and things like that, and also the podcasting that I've done. I am a rank unpaid amateur when it comes to these prognostications. But I do find, for the most part, that when I look at the overwhelming number of credentialed historians in the academic milieu, I always find them wanting in the way they do their business. I mean, we have one example in Michael A. Bellaseels, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. This is from the year 2000, in which he was awarded, but then he was denied that award ex post facto when Clayton Kramer went after his footnotes and went out after everything. In summary, what Bellaseels said in Arming America is that the American gun culture that had been celebrated in the 17th, 18th, and 19th, going into the 20th century, was a falsehood, and that American guns were rare and not on the frontier and such. What he was doing was he was committing the chronological conceit that he was taking the presentism mores of today, and he was projecting them backwards in service of a contemporary victim and gun disarmament complex today, so that he could show historically that because gun usage was rare then, it should be even more rare now because we're, quote, civilized people. I urge you to, if you get a chance, go to the absolute demolition of this horrific historian who even lost his job at a university, surprisingly enough. That is Michael A. Bellaseels. And Clayton Kramer is the guy who did it, and he just did this extraordinary job of taking this charlatan down. I'll make sure that I put some of the references in the show notes so that you can take a look at that. But I just take that as a snapshot of a lot of the legerdemain, magical thinking, and just rank stupidity that is in the credentialed academic ranks where they practice so much presentism, again, projecting one's contemporary mores and morals back into the timeline of other nation states or cultures or whatever, and trying to make it so that they are less or more moral than yourself. It's a form of virtue signaling that is academically bankrupt. Let's lay out a baseline here. What makes me an amateur historian a sober historian? I'll give you three rules that I generally go by, and that would be the Woketopians and the government supremacists in America think it is all about power. And by the way, they're right, but they think the right authoritarians will bring utopia. And I know that all political power leads to evil deeds. Number two, good history is interpreted and written by those who know altruism is always a lie. And number three, Buperts' corollary to Acton's axiom, power attracts the corruptible, and absolute power attracts even worse. Now, you can agree or disagree with these. And by the way, I love rational and robust and intellectually informed differences with whatever statements I make. Please be sure to write me or go to my Substack, make your case, and believe me, if your evidence is superior to mine and I find that your argument is so compelling, I am willing to examine that and say, yea and verily, I may be incorrect. So that's the preamble to what we're going to do in this particular podcast series. So apart from Chasing Ghost, whose milieu and concern is irregular warfare, I have expanded the portfolio in a rather infinite fashion to involve all warfare, all conflict, all of these things that I've been concerned about in the past that didn't quite shoehorn into the Chasing Ghost podcast. So this will be a companion podcast to that. For instance, everybody knows, for the most part who has listened, that I have a bone in my teeth when it comes to the use of aircraft carriers. I consider them to be the chariots and crossbows of the 21st century. I consider them to be future fish apartments in which thousands of young men and some women will drown, perish, burn, and suffer and die in ways that are unimaginable in the comfortable situation that most of us find ourselves in. So in a brief apologia to my persistent and loyal readers and listeners on the Chasing Ghost podcast, you will probably no longer see many excursions. I've always used that term, excursions, when I'm sort of writing and coloring outside the lines of what is the specific mission set that I had in Chasing Ghosts. So here we are. So what is the title of this particular episode? War Notes Reanimating the American Military Corps. What could that possibly mean? Here's what it means. I am going to tell you something that you won't hear in the terrestrial TV programming media, that you will find on some podcast milieus, but the received nationalist and triumphalist architecture of the information age regarding American military power in the 20th century and 21st century is that it is the unimpeachable and always winning hyperpower astride the planet that always does the right thing, that always wins its war so effectively and always does so well. This is all patently false. And I'd like to recharacterize and expand one of my notions that occurred early in my Chasing Ghost podcast series, which inaugurated a little over 2 years ago. And that's the concept of fragility and anti-fragility. So Nassim Taleb wrote a book called Anti-Fragile and a number of companion volumes that I would urge all of my listeners to check out if you get a chance. But what he basically says is that a system is either fragile or anti-fragile. Now, a fragile system is one that we're all aware of, which is where if one part of a link of chains or objects and modalities within a network fails, then the entire network can come collapsing down like a house of cards. Anti-fragility, on the other hand, is something that, in a very Buckminster Fullerian way, strengthens, stabilizes, and possibly even gets smarter, depending on the modality that we're talking about. I'll give you several instances of this. I would posit that free market systems are very anti-fragile and very resilient. They're both of those things, even though both of those things don't have to be in chain with each other. I would tell you that weightlifting, for instance, is where one is, well, this probably applies to all athletic activities, where there is a certain amount of creative destruction that takes place within the muscular skeletal structure of athletes. And over time, and with the burdening beyond capacity of those muscles and such, you get better over time as a result of being exposed to the stress. The same thing applies in warfare. That graybeard who has been on the battlefield for 30 years is going to be far more dangerous than the gentleman who just got out of boot camp, finds himself in the fray, and is on the two-way range. His survival is not going to be so dependent on the battle drills that he has instantiated and his intuition engines because he doesn't have the time, he doesn't have the investment in training that would apply to that. So that soldier who just got out of boot camp is going to be far more fragile than the rather anti-fragile soldier who's got decades of military experience in a combat theater under his war belt. Another example would be, again, I mentioned Buckminster Fuller. For those who aren't familiar, he was a visionary from the 60s and 70s who had an impact of sorts on the way I look at systems engineering, and I think that those who aren't systems engineers, I am a systems engineer by trade, those who aren't professionally credentialed to be so, that one can examine systems engineering books and you find that systems of systems thinking is vital to successfully prosecuting the most difficult projects, much like Elon Musk has done with rocketry and what he's done with SpaceX, which is arguably one of the most difficult and complicated tasks, scientifically and engineering-wise, that mankind has taken upon themselves. Now, Buckminster Fuller developed what he called the geodesic dome. And many of you are probably familiar with the high wind, very cold environments in the Arctic and the Antarctic, where you have these radar sets. Those radar sets, when you look at them, most 99% of these radar sets almost look like ocean sails, and they're huge. Now, of course, what happens, and you don't have to be a physicist or a weather person to know this, why do sailboats go across the water? Because you have this object on a very sophisticated vertical stanchion that takes wind power and converts it into forward movement. Same thing applies in the Arctic and the Antarctic when it comes to winds that can exceed 100 knots. Once they hit the sail, which isn't connected to a ship but the ground, it will collapse. So they said to themselves, a number of folks, and I think that planetary-wise, this has been adopted, let's put a dome over it. Well, why would you put a dome? Well, put a geodesic dome over it. Well, why would you do that? Because Fuller proved, and we don't have to bore you with the mathematics and the physics behind it, that when you put a dome over something like that, once the wind hits it, whether it is a microburst at one of the portions of the dome or the entire dome, what it does is it translates all of that energy that hits the dome at that moment over the entire structure, diluting the force and allowing the wind to pass harmlessly over it without collapsing either the dome or the radar inside. To me, I know it may be a little difficult to grok, but that's a great example of anti-fragility, in which not only does it dilute the power of the wind, but it also becomes stronger in the process. So, with that rather lengthy preamble, thank you for suffering with me. Here is my notion that I proposed in episode 2 and 4 of Chasing Ghosts. In this case, Chasing Ghosts, which deals with irregular warfare, I made this proposition. I said that successful Western counterinsurgency is impossible. And I'm not going to bore everybody here with what those notions are about. You can go back to episodes 2 and 4 of the Chasing Ghosts podcast, where I go into the nuts and bolts of why I think that is the case. And I make the historical and systems of systems case for why that is the way things are. But what I'm going to propose here is that I'm going to take that very premise. I'm going to expand it to all warfare conducted by the West, and America in particular. And I'm going to tell you that when it comes to the conduct of warfare by America, despite this $1 trillion budget every year, it is a road to oblivion, stalemate, and defeat every time. And I want to illustrate this with a short story that was published by Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote 2001 A Space Odyssey and some other follow-on volumes. It was published in 1951. Called Superiority. Now here's the plot. The story is told in the form of a letter pleading to a court, deciding the fate of the former commander of a great Allied space fleet. He starts the letter by describing that their final defeat was due not to the inferiority of their forces, but their superiority. When the war opens, the Allied forces have a great advantage, both in number of spaceships and the power of their weapons. At the Battle of the Five Suns, the enemy does surprisingly well, although ultimately losing. Spooked, the Allies confer with their new chief of the research staff, Professor General Norden. He states their existing weapons have reached the limits of the potential and begins development of terrifyingly powerful new weapons. The first of these is repeatedly delayed, and the Allies pause their attacks while they wait for their ships to be fitted with the new missiles. The enemy uses these delays to capture several former Allied systems. Instead of simply counterattacking with our current weapons, Norden develops still newer weapons that will make up for these losses. Each is temporarily successful, but each invariably leads to insurmountable problems and further losses. The story ends with the author admitting their defeat, but begging the court's favor as he can no longer be held responsible for my future actions if I am compelled any longer to share my cell with Professor Norden, late chief of the research staff of my armed forces, end of quote. Oh my gosh, the things that one can draw and pick out of that are incredible, and I wish that I could make this mandatory reading for all flag officers and SES personnel in the Pentagon, but I don't think that will ever happen because of their own hubris, and they've been living in this echo chamber, this house of mirrors, this fart bubble, as it were, in which they are never exposed to the red teaming 10th man or contraindicators of what they're doing that shows that they are going in the wrong direction. So I want to entertain three revolutions in military affairs for your delectation. And that would be this. Revolutions in military affairs are where all of a sudden, in a period of time, it is discovered that a technology or the employment of said technology changes the face of warfare forever, east and west, in a planetary fashion for those armies and conflict modalities savvy enough to take up the reins of the new thing. For instance, the stirrup. What did the stirrup allow to happen? It allowed dragoons and archers to actually be able to control their horses in greater numbers, by the way, because it didn't demand the tremendous athletic lower body strength without stirrups to ride horses, especially in a cavalry fashion. By the way, cavalry is bifurcated into two things historically when it comes to horse-bound soldiers, and that would be cavalry and dragoons. Cavalry fights from horseback. Dragoons fight from horseback, but once they arrive at the engagement area, they dismount and fight as soldiers. The combustible cartridge, moving on to the smokeless cartridge, became revolutions in military affairs, along with machine guns. And remember, the employment, the concept of operations, the concept of employment, the functional descriptions of this technology is always conjoined to the able way to employ said technology in a smart fashion. For instance, if we fast forward to World War II, we find that while Japanese submarines would primarily go against warships, U.S. submarines, and I'm not accepting that they didn't go after warships, but for the most part, their prey was the commercial shipping of the Japanese Empire so that they could rob them of the logistical tail that they needed to prosecute their war in their greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere. Again, technology identical, these submarines, but considerably different employment of them to achieve operational and strategic ends. There are three revolutions in military affairs, and I'm only enumerating three of them because there's many more in my estimation, but those three revolutions in military affairs are going to be hypersonic weapons, both offensive and defensive employment, robotics, and autonomous targeting. Now let's take those one at a time rather quickly if we can in the name of time spent here. When it comes to hypersonics, what causes hypersonics to send many contemporary soldiers and military folks to the fainting couch is that this thing will land in your lap before most conventional sensors can detect them and through that detection service those targets in a timely fashion. Much like what has happened, and again, I discussed this in the Chasing Ghosts podcast when it came to the Russian Strike Fire Reconnaissance Complex, where they have sort of broken the code of putting metal on target in a fashion that the U.S. and the West can't come close to. So it isn't only the fact that these hypersonic weapons can exceed Mach 5, which I think is right now the stipulation for making them hypersonic in the first place, but that what if there is terminal maneuvering? Because terminal maneuvering, when it comes to prosecuting and servicing incoming missiles, is the be-all and end-all of difficulty in probability of kill and the ability to take these out in salvo competition. Salvo competition being who can weigh and send and launch the greatest throw weight of munitions on either side in a near peer or peer conventional fight. And no matter how sophisticated your integrated air and missile defenses may be, in the end, it always becomes a war of leakers. In the end, it always becomes a war of, well, if you have a 90% kill, which is very improbable right now, especially for America and the West, of incoming munitions, that does mean that 10% are going to come and fall in your lap. So these are revolutions in military affairs that has completely changed the wharf and woof and permutations of how near-peer and peer conflict is going to be conducted in the 21st century. And it's only going to get worse with time. And what has happened as a result of a conflation of all of these circumstances that are going on around the world and these unintended consequences, it means that for the most part, the BRICS countries, the Russia, China, and surprisingly, even Iran, are, I would not say mastering, but well ahead of the power curve when it comes to prosecuting and using hypersonic weapons to do what needs to be done in this emerging salvo competition, much more ably than the United States is capable of, apparently. And if you read my blog posts, which are posted about 3 to 5 times a week, where I talk about the malfeasance and mission ineffectiveness of the Western military conflicts and complex at the Libertarian Institute, and I'll put that in the show notes, you will discover that I think we've invested, and this is what we're told, of course, there could have invested more, $10 billion in 2 aborted hypersonic weapons programs in the United States. I don't think there's any Western nations on the European continent who are making things any better in that particular milieu and able to do so. It's disappointing, but there it is. But it's here to stay. No one is going to be able, much like nuclear weapons, to put that genie back in the bottle. So whether you agree with it or not, hypersonic weapons, both offensive and defensive, are a revolution in military affairs. And by the way, if one takes hypersonic weapons that have terminal maneuvering capability on their way down to their said target, when it comes to sensors detecting, cueing, and establishing that, yea and verily, it is not neutral, it is not green, it is not friendly, it is a red threat, terminal maneuvering makes fire solutions even harder. And by the way, none of this is new. April, May 1945, when you look at the picket ships off of Okinawa during the most intense kamikaze suicide plane campaign at the end of World War II for the Japanese, you discover that the modeling and the behavior of those planes, not at hypersonic speeds, but certainly at terminal maneuvering instantiations, provided sort of like a window in what the future would show us in the 21st century of what that looks like. For instance, what you discover in the Battle of Midway in 1942 is torpedo technology in the U.S., and this is a story for another podcast, was just awful by the U.S. and the West. The Japanese, with their long lances, had a torpedo technology at the beginning of the war that was just astonishing compared to everything else on planet Earth, to include the fact that in 1941 and 1942, the premier naval aviation capability on planet Earth wasn't the United States. It was the Japanese until Midway. And at Midway in 1942, where they lost the 4 carriers that were all an integrated systems of systems naval aviation carrier force called Kidoputai, they were decimated not by torpedo bombers, but by dive bombers. And what made the dive bombers so interesting at the time, remember, we're talking about 1942 technology here, is that when the engineers and the operations research folks looked at this afterwards, they discovered that when you have a plane that is almost vertically closing with your ship and it releases its munition, no matter how much metal you send up, two things happen. Number one, they rarely connected with the aircraft itself to kill the aircraft. But number two, let's suppose it connected with the aircraft, but when it's coming in at that ballistic trajectory, it may connect, but it doesn't mean it's going to stop its ballistic trajectory right into, in this case, the flight deck of the aircraft carrier. Second RMA would be robotics. This means that the absolutely ubiquitous use of unmanned machines in the 21st century is not going to stop. It's going to expand. And what it puts into the hazard is manned tanks, manned fighter aircraft, manned submarines, manned ships. As a matter of fact, I would suggest for the first time in human conflict history, it has become rather inexpensive to go after that lone infantryman in the U.S. Army. He would be an 11 Bravo in the USMC. He would be a 0311. That lone infantryman or his fire team or his squad or his platoon when they are conducting their operations on the ground with a $50,000 Lancet III, as the Russians have used, as the Ukrainians have used in that conflict, as we saw used in the fall of 2020 in Nagorno-Karabakh in the Armenian and Azerbaijan conflict. What we discover here is that robotics, again, like hypersonics, is here to stay, and you can't click your red ruby slippers and wish them away. And finally, the third RMA, and by the way, I will tackle other RMAs that I have not necessarily created but discovered in my observations of human conflict in the 21st century, is autonomous targeting. And many will say, but that's Skylink, that's Terminator. That's, if we let the computers do this, then what's going to happen? I'm here to tell you we've been doing this since the 1970s. And all of you are familiar with that R2-D2 looking phalanx system that is on ships that sends up a wall of metal to intercept at the objects that are coming inbound to sink a ship or scratch the paint, depending on the size of the ammunition. Those have been used since 1970s with a very sophisticated radar set that is so sophisticated that if I were to fly a helicopter with the IFF, the Identify Friend or Foe beacon on it, and I start squawking that IFF code, it will allow me to get to within that near that fire stream. Fire stream will stop. I'll pass through it, and then it will continue the fire stream once it has identified that the IFF is no longer there. Now, I never want to test that, by the way, because I think that we're having a chaos avalanche of incompetence across the planet, particularly in the West, that is informing every aspect of civilization. So I wouldn't pledge my life to that, but I wanted to use that as an illustration that we've been using this kind of autonomous targeting for a while. Now, why is autonomous targeting important? It's important for a variety of reasons, but the topmost reason refers to my first RMA. If you put a human in the loop for the targeting cycle and the defense cycle for integrated air and missile defense, and you have them there and you have a hypersonic or a number of hypersonic munitions inbound, then what that's going to mean is that you won't be able to prosecute it in time before it lands where you are if you have a human in the loop, which means you have to have sophisticated computer algorithms in your C4I system that allows you to prosecute those automatically. If you don't find a way to do that, then of course you're going to lose that particular tactical engagement, if not entire conflicts, if that starts to cascade across the entire operational sphere of the war you happen to be prosecuting. Now, there are a variety of other things besides these RMAs that are putting the U.S. and the West in the hazard when it comes to war making, if they choose to make war making something they want to continue in the 21st century. I wish that weren't the case, but that doesn't seem to be the case because they meddle and they can't help but meddle. That would be M-E-D-D-L-E. Because there seems to be an almost unapologetic yen to always get in everybody's business. Which brings me to why we're doing this in the first place. I wanted to set up a multi-part series in which I would like to demonstrate to the DOD and the American and Western military establishments, how they can unscrew themselves, how they can take themselves out of what is essentially this massive, ineffective military-industrial complex that not only can't get out of its own way, but it simply can't win wars. The evidence is manifest from 1945 to this point. So what I'm going to seek to do in this particular series is first I'm going to tackle the strategic and grand strategic milieu to describe why America, and this is going to be shocking to some of my audience, should invest itself in becoming a regional hegemon and respecting other regional hegemons, and why the conceit of maintaining hyperpower unilateralism not only weakens, but could lead to the destruction of the American military organizational structure. So we'll cover that in detail. And then in the follow-on series, I want to go service by service to talk about what they're doing wrong, what I proposed them to do to right themselves, and ultimately to put a more positive spin on a lot of my prognostications and bloviations about war, the military, the U.S. and the West in particular, and how they have conducted themselves and not always draped themselves in glory and honor, and how we can get out of that business and how we can start conducting ourselves in a more civilized and less brutal and barbaric fashion. Ultimately, what I'd like to do is find a way for the military to fix itself from so many of the rake-stomping and self-imposed idiocies that informs so much of what it does, to maybe even improve this bureaucratic briar patch and this Sovietized and sclerotic acquisition system that has given us so many failed exquisite platforms in the past 50 years. Now, one can go back further to find even other exquisite platforms that don't quite meet the mail on delivering what they claim to do. But nonetheless, it has really accelerated into a cavalcade of calamities and a chaos avalanche in the last 50 years. I mean, for instance, the U.S. Navy, since commissioning the Arleigh Burke in 1991, has failed to deliver on a single surface vessel that is effective, that is applicable to the new 21st century modes of warfare, and that is going to prevail in near peer and peer conflicts. It simply hasn't done that. The Air Force has suffered the same fate with the F-35 and with the bombers, such as the B-2 and the F-117, and then, of course, the follow-ons to those, to the extent that we have these B-52s, the big buffs. Last one came off the factory floor in 1962, having their airframes certified to double their shelf life from 50 years to 100 years because the Air Force and the acquisition system can't get out of their own way to find an adequate bomber replacement for something that left the factory floor the last time in 1962. This is an indictment not only of the American military complex, but also of just the way the government conducts itself and does these things. The Army has the same problem where they have this manned tank and the IFVs and the Bradley, the infantry fighting vehicles, and all of these very sophisticated tracked vehicles, the Stryker among them, which is a wheeled vehicle, which don't meet the mail for the 21st century, and nothing's being done about it. I recall in the early 2000s, where there was a joint vehicle program that the Army spent billions of dollars on, canceled the program, and continued to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on once the program was canceled because they had to meet the contract demands. It's absolute insanity when you look across the board of what has happened. And yes, I will pick on the Marines, but for the most part, the Marines have adopted insanity to a lesser extent, although I am very disappointed in what the Commandant did with Force Design 2030. And I will cover all these in rich and gory detail in future episodes. But what I want to do is this. I want to lay out my evidence, my indictments of why they got everything so wrong. And then what I'd like to do is propose systems of systems, systems, acquisition, and warfighting changes that will bring the U.S. back to the top of the game. Now, will this be successful? Maybe so, maybe not. You'll be on the journey with me, and we'll see what you think. Your feedback is going to be invaluable to help me verify that my headspace and timing is correct in my prognostications. And we have an opportunity here. I am posting this podcast after the recent election. We have an opportunity here, apparently, to completely refit, reimagine, maybe even revitalize the way the U.S. and the West does their business in a more effective fashion, not necessarily efficient, because you can be efficient, but you're not necessarily effective. But if you're effective, most likely you are efficient, which is why I sort of have a beef with Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. It should be the Department of Government Effectiveness. But nonetheless, that's something that he and I differ on. So there it is. This is a new podcast. I've laid out the groundwork for what I intend to do for the first few episodes. I'm projecting that it may take 10 episodes to achieve what I just laid out. Who knows? We'll see what happens. Fortunately, I have the flexibility to do less or more to achieve the objective that I have. And then beyond that, I hope to continue doing this podcast where I talk about the larger framing of war and conflict. Historically, I've always wanted to dabble in the 30 Years' War because I think so much of what we suffer today resonates from then, along with all the other conflicts that have quite literally shaped the world. So I want to examine that in this podcast series after I complete what I just laid out as my objectives for the first few episodes. So I would enjoy hearing your comments and additions, deletions, gentlemanly recommendations, whatever the case may be. You can get in touch with me at my CG podcast email, which is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. If you would be so kind as say you're referring to War Notes, a conflict podcast, I can keep them segregated. I want to do a shout out to my middle son, Connor, who inspired me not only to do this podcast, but to name it as appropriately as it is. I do have a Substack, a Chasing Ghosts Substack, which you can find. That will also be in the show notes. And I really look forward to correspondence with folks so that we can travel on this journey together and you can help me calibrate what direction I may need to go on, what corrections I may need to make. So again, I appreciate your listenership. If you would be kind enough to leave a review on your favorite podcast vendor of just what you think of this podcast. And yes, I do appreciate honest feedback. So I look forward to you tuning in to this one. Thank you for listening to this one if you got this far. And I also look forward to hearing from you in the future. So this is Bill out.